From Iowa to Florida, Vermont to Hawaii, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, political pressure from teacher unions rather than science played a big role in guidance from the Centers for Disease Control on the reopening of public schools. Bill Kirpin from American Commitment is here with details. A trove of newly released emails shows Dr. Anthony Fauci was more of a spin doctor than a medical doctor during the COVID-19 pandemic. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Senator Elizabeth Warren wants to beef up the IRS budget, supposedly to collect more taxes. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine talks with Andrew Wilford of the American Taxpayers Union Foundation. And the founder of Black Lives Matter was heavily influenced by Marxism in advocating for the abolition of all societal structures. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College explains on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. It is now clear that teacher unions put political pressure on the Centers for Disease Control to delay the reopening of public schools. To learn more, we turn to the president of American Commitment, Phil Kirpin. Phil, welcome back to American Radio Journal. Phil, one of the most difficult and controversial components of the COVID-19 pandemic has been how schools deal with the pandemic, whether or not they're open, whether or not they are being done remotely or virtually. Teacher unions have had a big impact on this. Before we get to the specific impact of the teacher unions, talk a little bit about the science that should be governing the reopening of schools.
We've had pretty compelling evidence for over a year now that schools really should be running essentially normally, that the risk in school settings, even at very, very high community transmission levels, is relatively low, that children are significantly less likely to catch the virus or transmit it in school than they are out of school, and that to the extent that there is transmission in schools, it's generally transmission from staff. And therefore, you can, at times of very high transmission, you can be careful with things like pick-up and drop-off, interaction with parents, the staff, distancing, that kind of thing. But because children are such poor transmitters of this virus, they tend to be low risk even at very high transmission. And we've had a lot of evidence of that for a long time. The most recent is probably the CDC paper out of Wisconsin, where they found that even when there was 40% positivity countywide in the county where they did the study, there was very, very little COVID in the schools, and they concluded you could run pretty much normal school even at very, very high transmission levels in the broader community. And so the virus itself really didn't justify school closures or hybrid schedules or masking or any of the containment measures that were put into the schools. And, you know, the Trump administration CDC even kind of said this, although they did a very poor job of communicating it because they basically said, look, all the schools should be open, and we don't really need containment in them, but people are scared. And so in order to help that fear and to get schools back that don't want to open, here's a whole laundry list of crazy restrictions and rules that you can put in. Of course, once they did that, the guidelines became a must instead of a can, and we had a lot of problems subsequent to that, actually getting the schools open, but in the liberal areas that cared about things like the CDC guidance. And then, of course, the number one determinant, which is the point of the article that we're talking about, the number one determinant of whether schools were open or closed and how normal they were if they were open was had nothing to do with the level of virus in a given area. It was the level of union influence, of power that the teachers' unions had, and places where they were most powerful, schools were closed for a very, very long time and then maybe eventually open part-time. In places where the teachers' unions were less powerful, we had a full year of full-time school.
One thing that I noticed throughout this, Phil, is that in the areas where you did have really powerful teacher unions, particularly in urban areas, Los Angeles and some of our other major cities, the unions seemed to add a lot of demands onto returning to the classroom that didn't, to me, seem to have anything to do with COVID. Did you observe that as well?
Yeah, we saw that there were a couple places we really saw pretty shocking examples of this. Los Angeles was one, I think. Durham, North Carolina was another. They just put out these laundry lists of political demands of things like defund the police and legalize illegal immigrants, just sort of like laundry lists of left-wing political demands. And they said, we can't go back to work until you meet these demands. And so I think in the places where they were really powerful, they didn't even see much of a need to pretend that their concerns were safety related.
Throughout this whole pandemic, the left has viewed, quote, science as the holy grail of how we should proceed. But it has recently come to light, Phil, that apparently the teacher unions put their thumbs on the scale of science when it came to the CDC. Tell us a little bit about that.
In February of this year, everyone was expecting CDC to put out guidance that basically said all the schools can open now. And the reason that was expected was that the politics of inflicting maximum pain and paralyzing families and society dissipated with a Democratic president. You know, a lot of us assumed, you know, they're just trying to beat Trump. This stuff's going to more or less go back to normal shortly thereafter. And we thought there were a lot of indicators that the February guidance was going to basically say kids should be back in school, schools should be open, because there was so much overwhelming science and there didn't seem to be that much of a political upside to continuing with the school closures at that point. But there was a big surprise. Instead, the guidance came out and it was really far in the other direction. In fact, if it had been followed, and I think most places ignored it, but if it had been followed, it would have called for thousands of schools that had been open all year long without incident to close, because it had this ridiculously stringent standard for community transmission that put about 90% of the country in the red category, and it said in the red category, schools should be closed, virtual only, sports should be virtual only. It had all these recommendations that were completely unreasonable. And what ended up being the behind the scenes on that, Lohman, is basically they were trying to pass this $1.9 trillion spending bill that Biden had proposed, and it had $125 billion for K-12 schools in it, almost none of which is spent this year. It starts being spent for the most part in 2023 and later. But I think the teachers' unions and the Biden White House basically agreed, look, let's keep the screws to people, let's keep the schools closed, and they'll beg for this bill to pass, and you know that's how we'll get it over the finish line. And in fact, they all went out and did media appearance where they said, look, you know, we just can't open the schools until they pass this spending bill with $125 billion that doesn't get spent until 2023 anyway. And there were whole sections of that school opening guidance that was really a closure guidance that were cut and pasted from documents provided by the teachers' union. We later found out, because Adam Laxalt's group did FOIA requests and was able to obtain those documents. And we also know the head of the second largest teachers' union, Randy Weingarten, who sort of spearheaded this effort, she had the cell phone number of the CDC director and was calling her and lobbying her directly, and had input not just for those sections that were cut and pasted directly, but you know, for the more significant decisions about the tiering with the community spread and the 6-foot distancing, which was based on zero science. And essentially, they turned what should have been an opening guidance into a closure guidance at the behest of the teachers' union and sort of the political strategy of the White House.
Bottom line here, Phil, what's the impact on students? All this seems to center on teacher unions and political power, but at the end of the day, education should be about the students. So all these extended closures, I have to think that this is going to have a very serious, severe, and draconian impact on students going forward.
This is sort of the big challenge that we have now as a country, and you know, I hope that everybody who was on all sides of the school debate and the COVID debate, I hope we can all pull together and recognize that catching kids up has got to be the number one priority. And that means both academically and in terms of social emotional development and mental health support, because we've had a real crisis among our school children as a consequence of this very unfair treatment of them that they've suffered over the past year. And there are a lot of places that are doing summer school programs and other sorts of outreach to try to bring kids back up to date. I think, at least for what I've seen in my own kids, the social-emotional part is even more important. And I think we all have to make an effort to get as many activities going, as many play dates going, get kids, you know, as much into full socialization as possible.
Phil Kirpin is president of American Commitment. Phil, tell us a bit about American Commitment, and where can folks go to read your op-ed on this topic and the other research provided by your organization?
We are a national free market advocacy group. We work really on all the fiscal, economic, and regulatory issues, and we try to focus on things where a little bit more citizen engagement and knowledge can make a difference and tip things in a more free market pro-growth direction, so we get people the facts and the information they need to be more active, engaged citizens. And all of our stuff is on the website, americancommitment.org.
Phil Kirpin of American Commitment. Phil, thank you for being back with us.
My pleasure.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Our regular listeners know he keeps an eye on political developments for us, as well as developments in the nation's capital, of which there are some very significant developments this past week. Scott, good to have you here.
Great to be back, Loman. Thanks for having me.
Well, Scott, the COVID-19 pandemic, we're now, 14 or 15 months into this, and going back to the very beginning, Anthony Fauci was the expert, the person that everybody looked to for information and answers. This past week, a trove of emails has come out, and it looks like, in many ways, the good doctor wasn't quite square with the American people. Can you first of all fill us in on what the developments have been?
BuzzFeed News obtained about 3,200 pages of Anthony Fauci's emails through a Freedom of Information Act request. So he's using his government emails, which subjects him to open records laws. And these emails ended up getting turned over to BuzzFeed, and a lot of the emails have been released to the public. And what we're learning now is that Anthony Fauci was not straight with the American people over how the coronavirus originated. He was not straight with the American people on really what it meant to have mask mandates and asymptomatic spread of the coronavirus itself. The guy really is sort of paraded out as a hero of the coronavirus pandemic. You're talking about somebody that has held his position for really multiple generations. And he's been in the job since the early 80s. So really, for the last 40 years, Anthony Fauci has basically been leading the National Institute of Health, academic relationships throughout the world, and working with other research labs like the Wuhan lab in China. And I think that what we're learning from these emails is that he was warned very early that they were using gain-of-function research, which means they were basically supercharging these viruses in the laboratory. And obviously, it was not a natural development out in nature. This is constructed by the Chinese as basically a biological weapon. And Fauci knew, but he didn't tell Donald Trump, he didn't tell Mike Pompeo what exactly he knew. We saw that Mark Meadows came out this week and criticized Fauci for withholding information from the coronavirus task force at Meadows and Mike Pence and Dr. Birx and others were working closely with Fauci. And so I think it's a real problem when the American people look to people that are really supposed to be trusted, like Anthony Fauci, in these senior-level government positions. And ultimately, he knew that he was lying and withholding information and really trying to protect his own reputation through really what's at risk now, insofar that, you know, we got to make sure another pandemic never happens again, and we're going to learn how exactly this virus originated, if U.S. taxpayer dollars and the NIH were accommodating that research and knew about it. And I think there's really a lot of information to come out. We're looking forward to having Anthony Fauci back in Congress testifying before the Senate and the House.
That will be a very interesting hearing. So apparently, although the message was we should trust the science, we couldn't trust the scientist. So if you look at this, Scott, not only did you have Anthony Fauci not being square with the American people, so trust in the Centers for Disease Control and the science that is supposedly put out as fact by the federal government has really been violated here, but also talk for a minute about the news media. They covered it up, and a lot of it, of course, had to do with not giving Donald Trump any credit or giving him the ability to manage the pandemic. Talk a bit about how we've also lost trust in the institutions of the news media as well.
The big hook there, connecting the news media and these senior leaders at various institutions, federal institutions like the NIH and CDC, is big tech. And one of the emails that was actually leaked that came out through the BuzzFeed FOIA request is that Mark Zuckerberg was emailing directly with Anthony Fauci and offering to help with messaging. And we saw what Facebook did in terms of all their flags and alerts that they threw on every post that was related to the coronavirus or a vaccine or any health issue over the last 18 months. And the way that big tech has basically manipulated a media narrative as well that I think has been complicit, it's a real problem. And so we all saw what happened in the 2020 election. There are a large number of voters that have lost trust in federal officials to hold free and fair and elections that we can all trust the outcome on. Whether or not you believe that there was voter fraud at a high level that actually would have flipped the election results, I think that can be argued in a tone that doesn't just scream at everybody. But we also need to recognize that a lot of people have lost that trust. And then when this information comes out about Anthony Fauci, I think people are like, well, you know what? We were right. And there's one person sitting in the United States Senate right now that is basically telling everybody, I told you so, and that's Dr. Rand Paul. I think a lot of folks remember his interaction with Fauci just about a month ago in the Senate. And Fauci, honestly, was lying before Congress. I think he should be held for perjury. And that's why I think that going forward, bringing him back to the Senate to hold more hearings and actually see if he's willing to tell the truth now that he's got these emails, how is he going to try to spin it? If Fauci's really been any kind of doctor over the last 18 months, he's been a spin doctor. He's been a politician that's been licking his finger, holding it up in the wind, and making decisions based on political narratives and political pressures, not based on the science. And that's what I think has got a lot of the American people quite upset now.
Well, certainly the American people have reason to have lost faith in a lot of our institutions. Although I will say you have folks like Dr. Rand Paul, as you've pointed out, as well as a number of Republican governors like Ron DeSantis in Florida, who have actually been right and handled this properly. So there is some hope for the future through all of this. We will, of course, keep an eye on this and other major developments with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, a few words for us about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. We're focused on economic freedom and liberty. And so if your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. You can follow us on Twitter at Club for Growth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Senator Elizabeth Warren thinks trillions of tax dollars are going uncollected, and she wants to give more money to the IRS to go after those funds. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine gets details from Andrew Wilford of the American Taxpayers Union Foundation.
Elizabeth Warren has a plan to spend a bunch more money beefing up the IRS's tax enforcement, basically spending more money on the tax cops who will come look through your bank accounts and your financial records to collect as much revenue as the government thinks you owe. In theory, this plan could close the so-called tax gap of $1 trillion. That's more money, of course, that the government can spend on all sorts of things that President Joe Biden is proposing to do. But is that number accurate? That's what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Andrew Wilford. He is a policy analyst at the American Taxpayers Union Foundation, and he joins us on the phone now to poke some holes in this idea that Senator Elizabeth Warren has. Andrew, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Thanks for having me on, Eric.
Let's start with this idea of a tax gap. This is a thing wonky folks like us talk about this occasionally every year when the president's budget comes out, I guess. Probably not a thing that most people out there are that familiar with. What is the tax gap, and briefly, what is Senator Elizabeth Warren proposing to do about it?
So the tax gap is the gap between how much taxpayers owe the federal government and how much the federal government is able to collect. The actual size of it is somewhat nebulous, because if we knew all the revenue that wasn't being collected, then it would be a lot easier to collect. But when we talk about what Elizabeth Warren wants to do about it, she's saying it could be as large as $1 trillion. That's really on the high end of estimates. You can't know exactly what it is, but it's much more reasonable to suggest that it's closer to $500 billion than $1
trillion. Is this people who are cheating on their taxes, or is this people who just don't really know what they owe? Is it how do you even get to this number?
So definitely the media likes to portray it as people who are just tax cheats, tax dodgers, things like that. But there's definitely a lot of accidental underreporting. As we all know, filing your taxes is not that simple, and there's a lot of ways to make mistakes, and a lot of people do it honestly.
You've got a piece, Andrew, this week up at Real Clear Markets. People can find that at realclearmarkets.com, where you advise people to be very skeptical about Senator Warren's plan to throw more money at the IRS. You say in here that there's a number of different estimates in here, this $1 trillion figure that Elizabeth Warren thinks she's going to be able to squeeze out of these uncollected taxes. It's likely a much smaller number, probably like $300 billion, something like that. Nothing to sneeze at, of course, but not a $1 trillion. And then I guess you also have to factor in the cost of going after people, right? The cost of digging through and finding that extra money.
Right. So the official IRS number is $381 billion. So that's the kind of gap between what the official IRS number is and what Warren's talking about, which is $1 trillion. Her plan says that she can collect $1.75 trillion over the next decade. The Congressional Budget Office, which is the federal nonpartisan budget scorekeeper, would say that's way out of line with what you can reasonably expect from this kind of increasing enforcement funding. Closing the tax gap is kind of like when politicians talk about waste, fraud, and abuse. It's kind of free money that often never actually turns up because it's a way to raise revenue without actually having to quote unquote raise taxes. So kind of have to view it through that lens as just sort of a way to claim you're paying for something without actually paying for it.
Yeah, it's a way to put a number on a budget document that says, oh, yeah, we'll totally pay for this by doing this thing. And I think that's a good comparison to the waste, fraud, and abuse. You see that a lot, too. Oh, we'll just, you know, we'll find waste in the system and we'll redirect those dollars to a different means. And then, I don't know, sometimes it's hard to actually hit that figure. We're talking with Andrew Wilford. He is a policy analyst at the American Taxpayers Union Foundation, talking about his latest piece at realclearmarkets.com about Senator Elizabeth Warren's plan to throw a bunch more money at the IRS in the hopes of closing the so-called tax gap. Andrew, about a minute or so left here. Maybe this is just a totally crazy idea, but what if the tax code was easier so people could understand what they owed? Wouldn't that close the tax gap too?
Sure. That's part of it. You want to make the tax code simpler. You don't want taxpayers making these kinds of honest mistakes, and that really should be part of it. That should not just simplifying the tax code, but trying to help taxpayers rather than coming after them with the strong arm of the law as soon as they make an error.
But that's not what we're going to do. Instead, we're going to spend more money on the IRS so they can go after you, so they can get more money, so we can spend that money on other things. That's how big government works. Andrew Wilford from the American Taxpayers Union Foundation, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Eric.
And again, that's Andrew Wilford from the American Taxpayers Union Foundation. He's a policy analyst for them. Check out his work, his latest work at realclearmarkets.com. Be very skeptical about Senator Warren throwing more money at the IRS to close the tax gap. It's a great read. Check it out on there. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Check out more of our coverage of Biden's budget and everything else going on in Washington, D.C. at reason.com. And you can catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Radical Marxism is the basis for the Black Lives Matter's founders' call for the abolition of most existing societal structures. Dr. Paul Kengor from the Institute for Faith and Freedom at Grove City College has an American Radio Journal commentary.
Black Lives Matter founder Patrice Cullors has been in the news a lot lately because of controversy over her income and her financial dealings, including several recent purchases of several new homes in the last 4 years. But particularly striking Cullors' revelation of late is one that has gotten almost no publicity. It's a video by Cullors titled, "What is Abolition and Am I an Abolitionist?" Posted on her personal YouTube channel, which gets a huge amount of views, it needs to be widely watched. In that video, the Black Lives Matter founder repeatedly calls herself an abolitionist. She talks about her abolitionist journey and, quote, the abolitionist future that we deserve. She announces that she's writing a book titled An Abolitionist Handbook. There, in that video, Cullors applies her abolitionist goals most notably to police. And not just police, but even prisons and jails. There, the Black Lives Matter founder states flatly, quote, "Abolition is the getting rid of police, prisons and jails, surveillance, and courts," unquote. Let me repeat that. Abolition is the getting rid of police, prisons and jails, surveillance, and courts. That, says the founder of Black Lives Matter, is her goal. Wow. Alas, it's imperative here to pause to understand something crucial that helps make sense of where Patrice Cullors is coming from in this whole abolition theme. Cullors, as she openly notes, is a proud Marxist. She describes her, quote, ideological frame as that of a trained Marxist organizer who, as she puts it, is super versed on ideological theories. In interviews and in her memoirs, she speaks of her intensive study, reading Marx, Lenin, Mao, and other leading Marxists. She said in an April 2018 interview, quote, "We spent the year reading anything, everything from Marx to Lenin to Mao, learning about all types of global critical theory." Those of us who have repeatedly underscored these significant facts about Cullors have done so for very good reason. Namely, when Patrice Cullors tells us about herself, she's telling us something very instructive. This is her philosophy and her worldview. And utterly essential to the Marxist philosophy and worldview is the notion of abolition. Karl Marx and Marxism was all about abolition. The word is omnipresent throughout the writings of Marx. As noted by biographer Robert Payne, the word abolition seems to jump off of every page of the Communist Manifesto. Payne observed, quote, "And after Marx has abolished property, family, nations, and all existing societies, Marx shows little interest in creating a new society on the ruins of the old," unquote. Indeed, if you go online to various writings of Karl Marx and do a search on words like abolish and abolition, you'll be struck immediately, as with his use of the words criticize and criticism. The goal of the Marxist project is one of fundamental transformation, of pursuing nothing less than what Karl Marx called, quote, "the ruthless criticism of everything that exists." Above all, Marx in the manifesto acknowledged that communism seeks to, quote, "abolish the present state of things," unquote. Hear it. Listen to it. Say it out loud. Abolish the present state of things. That's Marxism. For those who think Marxism is about mere markets and wealth, chew that one over. Marx in the manifesto stated that communists, quote, "openly declare that their ends can be attained only by the forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions." Quite chillingly, Marx, who wrote about the devil, had a favorite quote from Mephistopheles, the Mephistopheles devil demon character in Goethe's Faust. That quote, "Everything that exists deserves to perish." So said Marx. That is reckless and irresponsible. In fact, it's as reckless and irresponsible as calling for the abolition of police, prisons, jails, surveillance, and courts, which is what Patrice Cullors, the founder of BLM, is calling for. Above all, Karl Marx, like Patrice Cullors, was an abolitionist. So when you hear Patrice Cullors, founder of BLM, talking about abolishing the police, and when you hear her calling herself a trained and studied and committed Marxist, you need to understand that that Marxism is not unrelated. For those liberals and BLM supporters who shrug off the fact that Patrice Cullors is a Marxist, well, you have a lot to learn. And above all, most disturbing is what this says about the destructive roots of the abolish the police movement that Patrice Cullors and her BLM have inspired. The Marxism, folks, matters. For American Radio Journal, I'm Paul Kengor. Check out my latest book, The Devil and Karl Marx.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KIRC-FM, KWSH-AM, and KSLE-FM in Shawnee, Oklahoma, along with WYBB-FM in Charleston, South Carolina. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.